Welcome to MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. Before we get started, you can check out our website, themacguffinmen.com. You can find all of our previous 266 episodes. We most recently talked about The Color of Money and The Hustler, in the opposite order. But those two films, the Fast Eddie double feature, and Space Jam and Sugar was our podcast before that. Check us out on Twitter, at themacguffinmen, where we tweet infrequently, but tweet to let you know what's up sometimes. Anyway, theme song.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James.
Yes.
We are continuing our People Don't Know How to Pour Beer series of podcasts. With the big heat.
Hey, for 35 cents, you can do the work.
You know what? That's a good point. But the thing is, like, if you're going to pour a beer like that, just don't pour the beer for me.
Yeah, I'd rather do the pouring myself, not terribly.
Yeah, exactly.
And your favorite trend of ordering just a beer and saying
anything. Yeah. Well, I mean, we talked about The Hustler, and so long throughout The Hustler, like, we didn't talk about this on the podcast. He's specifically asking for a brand of whiskey, JTS Brown, Eddie is. And then when he switches his order up to get a beer, he just asks for a beer. And I was like, oh, Eddie, you were doing it right.
Yeah. Well, they pay for their beer in this movie. That's another common one that never quite happens.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But I guess
anyway, great tangent to start.
We're starting on the most important point of the film.
Noirvember is on us. Yeah. And, yeah, we're talking about the Big Heat, directed by Fritz Lang, 1953.
Sounds right.
Based on a serial by William P. McGivern, and screen written by Sidney Baum.
All of these sound like names that could have existed in 1953.
It's true.
William P. McGivern, most notably.
Yeah. So what made this is one of your choices? What made you want to do the Big Heat?
I feel like I gave you a choice. It's just we were talking about podcast topics, and I happened to be going to see this movie the next day because it was playing at a TIFF, and I had never seen it, and I was just like, I don't know, Fritz Lang, people like Fritz Lang, and for some reason we didn't want to do Metropolis instead. Have you seen Metropolis?
I have, actually.
It's so good. It's like, it's amazing. Given that movie was made in 1927, it's absolutely staggering.
Yeah, it's weird.
But yeah, it was just a movie I happened to be seeing that I knew a lot of people liked, so why not talk about it?
Yeah, and the fact that it's still being, you know, played in theaters, you know, not all theaters, in TIFF.
Yeah. an 11 a.m. screening on a Friday morning. I was surrounded, like, these Friday screenings, they're always bussing in elderly people from, like, various homes. Like, the screening started 10 minutes late because they were waiting for all the elderly people to get their seats. It was quite adorable. Anyway, continue.
No, it was just to play a movie this old, you have to have some cultural importance, or at least be very well regarded, and The Big Heat is. It's not one that people really talk about a lot, but usually when people are speaking about it, it's held in very high esteem.
Mm-hmm. Like, I knew the title. I didn't really know much about the movie. I knew who Fritz Lang was, but the movies that came to mind for me when that name would come up was Metropolis first and then M second. So yeah, this was, I didn't even realize this was a Fritz Lang movie until I noticed that I was going to see it because it was playing, you know?
Yeah. So. And how'd you like it?
I think it's quite good.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yourself?
Yes. I think it's, quite good. And this isn't something I say a lot, but I think it's just paced really well. Like, it is a short movie. It's only 90 minutes, but I think it just kind of, it moves along really well, not too quickly, but I've watched it twice now, and there's just no real laggy parts. It seems just to be a very tight, well put together movie. I've seen the criticism that perhaps the ending is a little anticlimactic. There's not a lot of closure. I mean, we get to see a newspaper that says these people are put away. Yeah. But it finishes up rather quickly. I can kind of admit to that. But I think it is very, very economical, and just it just kind of goes along very well. And I found myself never really losing interest. And yeah, just really liked it front to back. And the story's good. I think the cast is good. I think, not that Glenn Ford's bad, but I think the supporting cast is fantastic in this.
Yeah, because Lee Marvin is a member of the supporting cast, and Lee Marvin is awesome.
Yeah, he's good at this. Gloria Graham's really good too, though.
Yeah, I know. I'm just a big Point Blank / Lee Marvin fan, so.
Yeah, and I was reading about this movie, and someone referred to him as ugly handsome, and I can't say that's wrong.
It's not, but he's also just handsome, you know? Like, that's the thing. He's just got, like, a weird-shaped head, but is a handsome gentleman. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
Anyway, Benedict Cumberbatch. Anyway.
but yeah, what you were saying about the economical pace, this movie is so economical that Banyan's wife blows up, like, her car explodes, that scene ends, and then the next scene is him in the office, and his boss saying, "I didn't get a chance to say this to you at the funeral." Like, they just skip however much time it's happened. It's just like, we're not interested in emotional distress, you know, we just want the explosion. But
yeah, well, and I think this this movie's interesting kind of along those lines, because it is released while the Hays Code is in effect, which, you know, people think of that as mostly concerned with sex and violence, which it absolutely is. But there's just a lot of moral stuff outside of those that the Hays Code's concerned itself with. And just the idea of being a vigilante was a big no-no to the Hays Code, because, you know, if the government's making rules, one of them shouldn't be take the law into your own hands. And, you know, I'm not happy the Hays Code was around or anything, but if I understand why that would be part of it if it is in effect. And this movie walks a fine line in a few ways when it comes to depictions of violence, dancing around the issue of sexuality, and the notion of vigilantism that I was talking about too. And I was just wondering how you thought about, like, did you think about the Hays Code being in effect for this time?
I will say I know less about the Hays Code than you do. It's always less present in my mind. One of the things, but on the note of vigilantism, one of the things that did surprise me was I didn't know the badge and the gun trope existed as far back as 1953. That always just sort of stuck as like an 80s cop movie thing in my, or I guess a Dirty Harry era sort of thing. So yeah, that was surprising to me.
I love the twist of this is my own gun too.
Yeah, yeah, that was great.
It
was
that's so awesome. Yeah.
It's a twist on some, like, we've seen a million badge and gun movies, and
decades after this.
Yeah, exactly. All of which were made decades after this, and this is the one where we're just like, oh, that's a nice twist on this thing I've seen a million times, you know. But yeah, you are right that the vigilantism, which that is tied to, is something that surprised me, but. I guess I didn't link it to the Hays Code, you know?
Yeah, but even with that, I just, that sort of metaphor of, you know, you can have my badge, you can have the job and all the rights that come with it, but you can't stop me from being a violent person or a vengeful person, you know? It's that badge and gun scene is always, you know, I'm going to take the law into my own hands, but to do it in that way, you know, to give up the piece of metal that has all these societal meanings, but to keep the piece of metal that, you know, is very effective in a very physical way, I thought was just a good metaphor for that. And it was, as you said, to have this come so many decades before that gets used so frequently. It was a really nice twist.
Yeah, I agree.
And I don't know, there's a lot of things, of little things that I like in this movie, kind of similar to that, I mean, maybe I'd seen them, but maybe it's just not overdone. I especially like when he's going to defend his, you know, his in-laws' apartment and his daughter at the end, and he gets the gun to his back from someone, and you assume that he's kind of done in here, and it ends up being someone on his own team that he hasn't met yet. I thought that was just one tiny thing that you drop little moments like that in a movie. It just elevates it so much for me, and I thought that was another great one.
Yeah, no, that's a really nice moment as well. I agree.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk a bit more about his vigilantism? Because he does, I think the way that they get around it with the Hays Code is that he does kind of walk a pretty fine line. He doesn't kill a lot of people. Mm-hmm. A lot of people die in this movie, and a lot of there is a lot of violence and bad things that happen in this, but it's more of him setting things in motion, whether he knows it or not.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know, because he doesn't even shoot Lee Marvin. Like, he doesn't, or does he just shoot to wound Lee Marvin in that final shootout? Does he actually hit him? I can't remember.
I don't think he he's yeah. got the coffee burns on his face, and then he brings him to the other cops and just says, you know, you can take care of him.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. I guess I don't have much to say because I haven't thought about it. But you are right that it is, he sort of continues things moving by him pursuing this, but he's not necessarily the person acting on everything, you know? He's just somebody that happens to be around a lot of these things that are happening.
Yeah, it just the really important deaths in this movie, you know, Larry's death happens off screen and not by him. Mrs. Duncan gets killed by Debbie. And what's it, is it Lucy Chapman, the first the B girl, yes, that he goes and meets?
Yep.
He's, I'd say, at least partially responsible for her death, but isn't the one who actually kills her.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Because, I mean, she gets killed because he's seen with her. Because, well, not necessarily him, but a cop is seen with her, you know, and not a cop on the payroll.
Well, and I think he talks to Vince about, not Vince, but his boss. Why am I blanking on this?
Oh, I don't. Just any cop would do. Yeah. No. I'm worse at names in movies than you are.
Yeah. No, Vince's boss.
Oh, Logano?
Logano, there it is. Yeah, and I don't think he... I think that's kind of an instance where he didn't need to do that and she ends up dying. I don't know. Yeah. Just thinking about where he is morally, you know, he's obviously... works outside of the law, but I would say with good reason. You know, he's working for a very corrupt, at least police force, maybe mm-hmm. entire local government. But he's not responsible for a lot of the... I mean, he's not the one who pulls the trigger on the people who die around him. Mm-hmm. You know, he sends a woman to Larry's door knowing that he's a murderer and someone yeah. involved with a lot of bad people, and nothing comes of it for her there. But I was just wondering where you think he is kind of placed on the moral spectrum for his actions throughout this movie.
Yeah, I don't know, because it does still feel like most of the actual action he takes is like a positive nature, and absolutely you are right that a lot of bad things happen because to other people specifically because of action that he takes. But I don't know, like I suppose the question is, should you give up because bad things have happened because of things that you've done, right? Like there's never necessarily like a really strong connecting thread that him pursuing this, like, because a lot of the things seem to be kind of tangential, too. And it was just bad luck that his wife died instead of him, like, that he didn't go pick up the babysitter.
Right.
So I think it's just sort of, it's, if anything, it's a comment on the idea that even though these terrible things keep happening to other people around him because he continues to pursue this thing, he still views what he's doing as good enough to make this sacrifice or to take this risk, you know? Because you never know if anybody's actually going to get hurt the next time. This just happens to be an unfortunate trend with people in his life, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, maybe not morally, but more about his personality. He comes close to killing people, and there's times where he seems a little unhinged. I mean, he says he wishes he killed some people. He, you know, chokes some people to get information. You know, all of this, keeping in mind that his wife was savagely murdered. Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying he doesn't have the right to be upset about any of the things that has happened to him, because he absolutely does. And, you know, his young daughters being threatened.
It never, like, if he had killed anybody at any point in this movie, it never would have been surprising. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Basically how I felt about him throughout the movie.
Right. And I just... Is it surprising he doesn't kill anybody, though?
I guess a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess, I don't know. I'm trying to think of other noirs and from this era and whether or not they always kill, like the lead always kills somebody. And I assume they do, but I can't think of any specific examples off the top of my head.
Right. Well, it's the first time noir's come up after my hilarious portmanteau of November. How much of a noir do you view this film as?
I mean, it's got a lot of shady dealings, and it doesn't follow the, I mean, if you're looking at the strictest rule of noir, it doesn't follow them all super closely, but I think it still fits in the general classification.
Yeah. Okay. And for what reasons? Which specific tropes would you point to as
time period? A lot of abuse against women.
Non-stop smoking
and drinking.
Lagana wakes up and starts smoking. That's a winner.
Oh man, I mean that whole scene is amazing when he gets woken up, takes the phone call, and then somebody lights a smoke for him, and then he's like, call Vince, and will not dial the number himself. He just sits quietly and smokes. They don't even cut. It's great. But yeah, just a lot of shady dealings and mobsters, corrupt cops, or corrupt authority figures, I suppose. There's always like, and the fact that it's black and white and from the 1950s, like it just sort of falls in line with the look of a lot of noir movies that I've seen previously. And whether or not, I would have held this opinion in 1953. I wouldn't have known as much about movies in 1953 because it would have been impossible. But if I was like a noir super fan in the 1950s, I'm sure the differences would be larger. But as an outsider at this point, it just feels like a noir, even though, there's no clearly defined femme fatale or anything like that.
Yeah, no, I'd say it's definitely, it hits a lot of those things. I'd say it taking place in a city. Just the bars and the streets and things like that. You mentioned the corruption, I think is a big part of it too. There's just a couple things that, like one thing for me, and I'd still classify it as one, but I just think there's a couple points that you could argue against it. I mean, and I think this is a really big one for me. And one of the things I like about noir in general is that mystery element. We know the whole world in this one, which is something that's, I think, very not noir. You know, this question of whether or not Tom Duncan committed suicide, I think, is answered within, 3 seconds of the film starting? Noir always strikes me as an important part of it always strikes me as that thing we don't know, that mystery element. Sometimes we don't know something, or sometimes our protagonist is duped or even corrupted by the end. But we know everything that's happened. We don't know everything that's going to happen because no one does. But there isn't that, whodunit or that case of mistaken identity or the unexplainable person or action that we don't get clarity on until the closing moments of the film. And I think that's... that kind of puts it in a different column a little bit for me.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, you're not wrong, and it's not like there's an example I have to be like, James, you're incorrect. There's this Peter Lorre. Didn't you see his character at all? But no, you are correct. I just sort of think, I don't know. It still feels like noir, even though it is missing that, as you said, crucial element of.
Mystery. And I think visually it's not as dark as the prototypical noir, right?
I don't know if there's a difference. I feel like it would be pretty slight because it still is a dark movie with a lot of hard shadows. Not as many as I'm thinking about the Maltese Falcon, where there's just shadow upon shadow bouncing around the room, but I don't know. I guess these are just things that didn't register with me. I saw a few hard shadows and I was like, noir, there we are.
I think it's got some Western vibe for me too. Mm-hmm. Like this is something that does happen in noir, or even just a crime movie or an action film, but the kind of vengeful ass kicking that happens, some saloon showdowns, poker, and as you said, lots of alcohol being consumed.
Yeah. comical amounts.
Yeah, it's I think it takes a lot from the Western as well. And I think part of that for me is just Glenn Ford being the star.
Yeah.
I mean, he's most closely associated with Westerns.
Mm-hmm. Well, to me, he's from Superman, the first Superman movie.
Okay.
Plays Pa Kent. The whole time I was watching The Big Heat, I was like, what do I know this guy from? And it turned out it was Superman, which I have not seen in like 15 years. But anyway.
Good for you.
Good for you, Glenn Ford. Four for you, Glenn Ford.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So I feel like money got mentioned a lot in this movie. Did you feel that way? Like, even more so than a movie about the mob typically does.
You mean the price of beer actually came up?
No, even aside from that, and you know I am obsessed with representations of alcohol in movies, but this is removed from that. It just felt like people were constantly talking about wages and how.
Oh yeah, that's true. I thought you meant saying certain dollar amounts, but yeah. Oh, wages is and being an heiress is mentioned a few several times on different occasions.
Yeah, and like the joke that Banyan makes when those other cops come to help him towards the end, he just says, "Are you throwing that pension down the sewer?" And and the cop that he says that to, his response is like, I'm breathing clean air for the first time. And I feel like this movie really is the thing that I found that was really interesting throughout the movie is that it seems to be this movie that is all about how money shouldn't matter all that much to you. And I mean, all of our villains are mobsters, and mobsters would generally be assumed to be mobsters so that they can make more money than they could legally, you know? Yeah. It's just sort of a quiet assumption that one would make. Lee Marvin, whether or not he actually was, certainly looks like a capitalist when you look at his face and listen to his voice. but like a dirty capitalist. But and just also the appearances that people put up throughout the movie. And again, this isn't surprising. The environments that the mobsters operate within seem much more gaudy than even the bar that they go to seems more gaudy than anything we see Banyan associated with in his life. Like when he enters into these other aspects of life, obviously, you know, he's in these richer appearing places, but,
he's entering their world.
Yeah, exactly. But, and even in that scene with him and his wife, where they're sharing the giant steak, together, you know, they're talking about how they won't get to have steaks anymore once their daughter goes to school, unless he becomes a commissioner. And finances are very much as they would be with any mother and father who are married, be a casual part of their conversation. And I just felt like money came up a lot. And this movie seems to be sort of take the stance that almost like money is a drug. Like if you take too much or get used to too much money or want money, then you end up becoming this like corrupt cop. Whereas Glenn Ford's character Banyan, he never really seems to care that much about money aspects of things so much as doing the right thing. Yeah.
Oh yeah, that's definitely his MO in this. And one more example is when he goes to Lagana's the first time and does the math on how many tax dollars it takes to have these police officers stationed there right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, and even like when the bodyguard comes through later in that scene, he walks in through a door and you can just see these people in the background. Like it's a party that Banyan shows up during, and there's just people dancing behind in this doorway. And it's just so far removed from what is actually happening in the scene, but it's also like in the same structure, you know?
Yeah. Just in the background of the shot.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think this movie does walk a nice line. The dialogue, I mean, there's obviously a few exceptions, but it never gets really stilted and tough to hear to me. I don't know. I've read some people do have a problem with it, but I think it's good. And the little speech he gives Lagana shortly after that moment you were describing about, you know, you couldn't plant enough flowers here at this house to get the smell out.
Yeah.
I think that's a nice little speech there, and it's a speech you've heard in, you know, variations of a million times, but especially in this time period, some things do age so poorly. I thought that was a good one and a nice little a little soliloquy that backs up your point about the power of money and that not being Banyan's concern at all.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you're saying, some things really can age quickly in this time period. I think the when he's talking about his wife towards at the very end of the movie, it sounds like he was like using a 1953 Mad Libs generator or something. Now he's describing his wife. It was amazing. Like, I can't even remember any of them because they were just so nuts. You know,
as someone's dying in his arms.
Yeah, exactly. And even after this woman has definitely died, he's still got one more in him. Yeah,
yeah. I think that's the main exception I'm thinking of for when this movie doesn't exactly age well. Yeah. But
I will say I really like the scene. I like all the scenes with Banyan and Mrs. Banyan. I think they were like weirdly, I don't know. It felt like a weirdly nice depiction of domesticity without it getting too 1950s-y, you know? Mm-hmm. I don't know. There was a sort of naturalism to the way that they work together that was pretty surprising to me, and something that I can't necessarily put into words because it was just entirely a feeling, but I don't know, I thought the way they worked together was really nice, you know, like I thought they, like, you could actually believe that they could potentially be married, you know.
Yeah, so what did you think of her role? I mean, this is post World War II. She's not the 1950s housewife that you know is the stereotype. Did you put any thoughts in that depiction of a woman or women in this film in general?
Well, I mean, that's one of my main questions about this movie is how are we supposed to view women in this movie? Because with very few exceptions, any woman that plays a prominent role in this movie dies. Basically the only exceptions are the girl who is not yet a woman, Banyan's kid, and the woman with the cane that helps Banyan one time. I don't remember her dying. Maybe she died at some point and I just missed it, and it was very quickly. But
to the viewer's best knowledge, nothing.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. There's no like quick scene of Lee Marvin being like, "Hey, another woman I should abuse because I'm a horrible person."
One of those background party shots who just had the heart attack.
But yeah, and that is something that like I was trying to sort out how I felt about. Because when all of your main female characters meet such horrible ends for the most part, what, like, one of them gets off easy by just being shot to death, you know?
Well, yeah, and Mrs. Banyan's wife might have been, her death might have been painless, but it's still pretty horrific.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if we are...
That's the best we're hoping for.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
That when her car exploded, she died quickly.
I mean, the fact that we are arguing about which one is the worst death, being shot or blown up in a car bomb, I think sort of kind of proves my point. But, like...
Well, and Lucy Chapman's is, like, atrocious sounding.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. When they said cigarette burns all over her body, I was like, I didn't know you could say that in the 50s. Like, to go back to your Hays Code thing, I didn't know that that was something that could get past censors. But yeah, women in this movie just all meet terrible, terrible demise, or ends. And I didn't come up with a good thing other than to say, and this is just a very simple blanket statement, that this movie is about the patriarchy and all men are the worst, you know? But like, that's so simple that it's boring and not interesting. But yeah, it's at least something better than all women are victims, you know? Or I guess it's exactly the same thing, but...
Yeah, I mean, to take a really pessimistic view of the worst... message, the worst reading of this movie I can think of ties into that, like, mm-hmm. not necessarily the patriarchy's bad, but I think that the worst reading I think is that the patriarchy's great, and Banyan and his wife have, you know, what I would imagine was a pretty modern or progressive relationship. You know, he is depicted as being an equal parent. I mean, he has a job, but they both discuss reading this baby book and how to treat the child, and he puts her to bed and reads the stories sometimes, and, you know, builds her little police station out of the blocks with her, even though he's had a rough day and his wife is home, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, they... and that he like kind of, he says something kind of rude to her in that scene and immediately apologizes for it.
Exactly. Mm. That's not the common depiction, right?
Yeah, exactly.
They cut the big piece of steak right in half.
Yep.
They sip each other's, or she takes, you know, they share cigarettes, they share beers, they share scotch. You know, this isn't June Cleaver. This is, you know, what I would imagine would be pretty cutting edge. Equal parenting. She's allowed to smoke and drink, and he doesn't get upset about it.
Yeah.
You know, normal stuff for now, but obviously not back then. Yeah. And I think that the big one that hits this idea home for me is that she drives the car and she dies as a result.
Yeah, you know what I mean? That's true.
They throw her keys and she catches it and she's like, yeah, it's no big deal. Women can catch things if you throw them sometimes.
A league of their own and whatnot.
Yeah, and then, you know, within 15 seconds, she's killed for operating an automobile without a man around. And I don't think that that's exactly why those things are in the movie, but I think that's, you know, maybe the worst way you can look at this.
Yeah, and, the darkest timeline, big heat.
Yeah, and tie that in with all these women meeting, you know, not just deaths, but pretty awful deaths. I think that interpretation isn't too far of a stretch, but Debbie is at least complex, you know what I mean? At least,
sorry, well, who, what's complex?
Debbie.
Oh, okay.
You know, I think the worst way to depict women is to be completely one-dimensional and only, you know, have no inner struggle, no interesting part of the story. And, you know, we meet Debbie, and it seems like ethically she feels she's not doing any of the bad things. She's just benefiting from the money that Vince receives by doing bad things.
Yeah.
And then I think her involvement with Banyan and becoming a victim to some things herself, she really kind of draws a line in the sand. And, you know, she carries that out by killing another woman. But that's at the expense of, for the purpose of highlighting these other horrible things that these men are doing. Yeah. So, you know, at least there's a dynamic character within that female role.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what you thought of Debbie's arc.
Yeah, I mean, I found Debbie very enjoyable when she was on screen. Like, I just enjoyed her performance. I thought she was she gave a really fun, good performance. Fun when she was allowed to be fun, and good when she was having hot coffee thrown at her. Yeah, I don't know. I found her the most interesting character, especially since when you meet her in the movie, you kind of assume she will be the femme fatale too, right? And she doesn't end up sort of playing a role like that. She does seem to be this type of person, this person that is, you know, at the beginning pretty sure of her place in the world, but starts to figure out that maybe that's not the best. And, you know, I think it's symbolized at the end when, or towards the end when she's talking to, I forget her name, but the other woman in the mink coat.
And Miss Duncan.
Yeah, Miss Duncan. And just saying how, you know, they're just wearing the same coat. They're the same type of woman. They're just
sisters in mink.
Yeah, sisters in mink. They're just there for Vince and his kind, the Lagana people.
Yeah, and just to turn the other way, but still reap the benefits.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know. I just felt like she was interesting, and the way that she viewed her life was pretty interesting. And yeah, I don't know. I liked her.
Yeah, and again, kind of a questionable depiction, but her beauty gets restored in her noble death. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Her facial scar gets covered.
Yeah, she gets the Harvey Dent face turn at the end.
Yeah, did you see a lot of Dark Knight in this too?
I mean, it's weird. When somebody's face gets burned in a movie, it's always the left side of their face. And I've never been able to sort this out. But it's been something that I've noticed. You know, definitely that element of it, I did. Mm-hmm. Is there more that I was supposed to see?
I mean, we've got a...
Is Banyan Gordon or Batman?
Banyan is...
I guess he's a bit...
He's mostly Batman.
Yeah.
I think.
He's Gordon until he becomes Batman.
Yeah, he's the timeline where Gordon becomes Batman.
I'm sure they have so many goddamn comics. I'm sure there's one.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Let's call Travis.
Yeah, I mean, okay, so we've got our... And I mean, all these bit by bit won't sound too convincing, but I think put together as a whole, you know, there's at least something there. We've got a corrupt government, particularly a corrupt police force, which is obviously very present in The Dark Knight. Mm-hmm. We have at least one, I'd say, surprising death of a prominent female character.
Yep. Via explosion.
That's true. Lots of, you know, tied to the corrupt government, you know, a lot of just meditation on vigilante justice and kind of where that line is.
Yeah.
Her face being burnt is what started this. That boat scene with D.Va.
I was just thinking the same thing.
No, I mean, it's, you know, it's not, I wouldn't say it's a direct influence, but I don't know. I saw those things and I thought that as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the, put a quick button on the Nolan talk because we don't need to talk about him much more than we already do. But that's kind of the appeal of Nolan movies is that he is able to, whether or not he knows it, he's taking all of these well-worn things and just tying them together in something that's not so obviously pastiche like a Tarantino thing, but is something that is all of these well-worn materials that are just put together in a nice, interesting package. Just like, you know, Heat was obviously a big influence on The Dark Knight. That was the one they talked about all the time.
The big Heat, I mean.
Yeah, no. Yeah, but you know, The Dark Knight isn't entirely removed from noir as a type of film. You know, there are elements of it in it, and just the big corrupt city. And you are right that there are elements from that in this movie. And but I also think there are elements of that in a lot of action movies too.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
The Two-Face thing is where it sets it apart. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean that coffee thing's then the first one's off screen, and then the second one is not.
Well, yeah, and I mean, like, I am in a room when I'm watching this movie. I'm in a room with, as I mentioned, it's me and I think the next youngest person in the room was 40 years older than me, and like when they said the cigarette burns thing, I'm just like, well, that's pretty horrible. And then like showing a woman having coffee, like hot coffee thrown on her. Like, I don't think you would do that in a movie now. Like, I just thought that was so, interesting is a terrible word, but interesting that they could do that. And, that they would do that in the 1950s. I don't know. It seemed so horrifying. And didn't seem like it fit with how I expected violence to be shown in the 1950s.
Yeah. I mean, with just the time period as it was, and then keep in mind the Hayes Code. And as I said,
I should point out there were gasps in the theater. That's why I mentioned the other people.
Okay. And keep in mind the Hayes Code, as I said before, isn't just about these really, about the images, but the notions. Like, you didn't want good guys getting away with things. You didn't want bad guys getting away with things. You didn't want good guys working outside of the system. This movie starts with a suicide. Like,
yeah,
as I said, right off the bat, someone just blows their brains out.
No, their brain remains contained in their skull.
Oh, right. Yeah. It's 1950s shooting.
People didn't die bloody until later on.
Yeah, those shootouts, they still kind of leave you wanting a little bit sometimes. But it starts with a suicide. Several murders, some of them pretty torturous and painful. Vince Stone burns that woman's hand. Just the entire city and police force seems extremely corrupt. Innocent people being killed, you know, his wife. There's his young daughter is seemingly being threatened with another violent murder.
Yeah.
And then, the two coffee face burns. It's a lot. Yeah. There's a lot of just intense, not just violence, but anti-authoritarian messages in this movie that, some of them you wouldn't even think you'd get away with in 2016, and then, you know, go what, 60 years back, and this is what you're dealing with.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, I guess Fritz Lang didn't really shy away from that kind of stuff. My understanding of his career.
Yeah, well, I mean, M is about a child murderer, so.
Yeah.
But he also made that movie in Germany. So.
True.
I also enjoyed the way that the movie showed, we've been talking about coffee burns for a while, but the how people care about their appearance or think about their appearance. And, you know, there's that line from Mrs. Duncan where she says Tom kept cheating on her because, you know, he was so vain. He needed to prove to himself that he's still attractive. And And that money thing goes hand in hand with making sure you have this nice, beautiful mansion where you can host this party. And
which he's not allowed to be seen at because his daughter wants to keep up her appearances of not being a daddy's girl.
Yeah, exactly. And all of the people that are considered even bad in even like a remote sense throughout this movie seem to care about their appearance. And it's only once, oh my God, I'm forgetting her name again. Once Debbie has her, you know, I mean, she's a beautiful woman. Then she has half of her face burnt off. It's when she learns to accept that she appears how she appears to the world, that she sort of becomes like a, I mean, she's a vengeful kind of good, but she still seems to be good and caring about Banyan's success in this venture that he's on. You know?
Yeah, and Stone's and Lagana's. I mean, she's just, it's not until then that she seems to be thinking about morality at all.
Yeah, or thinking about her place in existence at all. You know, she's just somebody that lies on the couch and drinks, you know, while Vince plays cards for the most part.
Yeah.
And I mean, the real thing that shows that is that Banyan is our hero because he's the one that he's accepting of the life that he has. He's like a working class cop, and he's fine with the wife and kid that he's got. And he's just sort of accepting of this normal life. And he's also honest. Like, he is the one that sort of just accepts his life for what it is and doesn't need anything more than that. And that's sort of why he is the good person in the movie. And I thought that was interesting, like just an interesting thread that runs throughout. And the thing that allows Banyan to actually move on at the end of the movie is that he finally stops caring about keeping that internal life internal when he starts talking about his wife as Debbie dies in front of him, is how he's able to actually move on, even though he's able to move on quicker than people typically would be after their wife is blown up in a car.
Yeah, yeah, and it's our the characters that we're supposed to dislike are the ones who we see preening themselves in mirrors, and Larry takes out the comb before Lagana shows up, and Debbie, you know, she kind of has like an opposite Harvey Dent arc, like pre-face burn.
Yeah,
she's a bad person, but post she's great.
Yeah, she's like Bruce Wayne pre-face burn and then two-face post.
Yeah,
but like Bruce Wayne when he's out at dinner. Sorry.
Yeah. Right. No, she's, you know, constantly checking herself in the mirror and fixing her appearance before her coffee incident.
Yeah.
And, you know, as I said, we see Larry checking himself in the mirror, and that's just something that Banyan and his wife seemingly don't concern themselves with at all.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Their life is what it is, and they love it, so they don't have to care about how it looks to other people.
And I mean, Debbie also cares about the way things look, not just her. I mean, I loved her line in his hotel room, which is, "I like this early nothing." That's just a funny line to me, but also points to her kind of vacuous nature.
For sure.
Yeah. So, what do you take away from the ending of this one? He's like, he's just back, and he's.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know that I take too much away from it other than, wow, he got over his wife pretty quickly.
Yeah. Well, we don't know when that is, I guess.
No, I know. I don't know. There's just...
Old pencil hands getting him some coffee.
I don't know. I guess I would say I don't take away anything from that concluding scene. I think that scene was probably just something where they felt the need to let us know that Banyan had something to do the next day, you know, like that he continued to live his life and that he didn't go quietly drink himself to death in a corner and cry about his wife, you know?
Yeah.
So I think it's that scene is slightly more than meaningless to me. Yeah. You know?
Yeah. This movie isn't one that seems to concern itself with endings too much, but I think there's just a lot the ethical questions and the struggles throughout, and how entertaining it is, you know, for the first 98% of it is, I think, what makes this movie so strong.
Yeah, I mean, I can even imagine a world where either they didn't shoot that last scene initially, or they hoped they wouldn't have to in the script, and then just realized that the scene previous just doesn't give you enough closure. Like, if the end had come up on screen as Glenn Ford is talking about lollipops and rainbows and his wife at the end, it just wouldn't have worked. So they needed some sort of button, you know. But I can imagine a world where some of the creative people behind this movie didn't really want to use that scene, or hoped they wouldn't have to, and then just sort of had to.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that is not based on research at all. That is entirely my hypothesis.
Yeah, no, but I think that makes sense kind of within this Hays code, is that our good guy is overcome and he's back working within the system because, you know, the corruption has been purged and you can trust the authorities again. And yeah, that the person who never wavered on his morality has come back within the system because it's you know, the self-correction is in place and he's managed to fix everything, and everything's back to the way that it usually is, which is the police and the government are great and are to be trusted.
And as we've seen in the intervening years, Glenn Ford saved everybody and nothing has changed since then.
That's right.
Yeah. Do you have anything more to add on the big heat? Any further heats? Little heats?
No, I'm out of heat. I'm heatless. I'm without heat.
Okay. So thank you for listening to The MacGuffin Man. Be sure to check back next week when we'll be talking about something else.